I have the distinct honor and pleasure of introducing to each of you the governor of the state of Utah. The Huntsman Reeds have a great family relationship. John Huntsman Sr. is a friend of mine. He's such a good person. He has done so much for the state of Utah and many other places. A more charitable man you will not find any place. He has basically devoted his entire fortune to charity. His son, John Huntsman, the governor of Utah, has been good to my family. He appointed my son, Josh, to the prestigious Board of Regents of the University of Utah system. Governor Huntsman was elected governor of the state of Utah in 2004. He served in various positions, including in the Commerce and State Departments of our federal government. He served in the Reagan White House. After becoming governor, he quickly placed clean energy and energy efficiency on the top of his list of priorities. As Republican governor, he believes a clean, diverse, secure mix of energy resources is essential to maintaining a state's quality of life and economic development. He recently instituted a four-day work week for Utah under the Working for Utah initiative. Under this program, the state will conserve energy, save money, and improve air quality. It's the kind of innovative thinking we need when we look to solving energy issues. I consider Governor Huntsman a key ally in beginning the clean energy revolution here in the West. I talked about some of the good things that Utah is doing with geothermal this morning in my remarks. It's my pleasure to introduce to you the governor of the state of Utah, John Huntsman, my friend.
There we go. Didn't know that a senator, I didn't know that the theme song came along with this august privilege. Thank you also very much for allowing me a few moments to be with you here. And Senator, thank you for that kind and totally undeserved introduction. It's an honor to be here, and I want to thank and congratulate all who are part of the theme of today's gathering, which is energy, which is clean energy. I can't think of a more important topic for us all to be getting our minds around. Although, you know, they say what happens in Vegas is supposed to stay in Vegas. I hope that in this case, we make sure it doesn't, because of the good ideas that are germinating here and being talked about. I hope that they spread throughout. You've had some great presenters and some great roundtables, and I hope that we learn something from what is being discussed today. Now, I'm reminded, because I left a few daughters at home this morning as they were preparing and going to school, of a great story between a father and a daughter. And it goes something like this. The father spent the morning building a new driveway, bringing in a concrete crew, having it all paved and having it all paid for, $3,000. The daughters came skipping home from school that day, saw the drying concrete, and couldn't resist the temptation. They took out a stick and started drawing names and hearts and arrows and names of boyfriends and whatnot. And the father came home later that day and saw what his daughters had done. They had destroyed the new driveway, the concrete that he had just poured. And he was outraged, and he called them into his home, sat them down, and he said, "Girls, I can't believe what you've done. You've destroyed the concrete. I just paid for it. It was $3,000. He was outraged. The girls looked at their father and were a little bit upset at him. They said, "Dad, you know, you're our father. You're supposed to love us. You're not supposed to get upset with us. You're supposed to love us after all." And the father looked, scratched his head a time or two at his daughters and said, "Yes, you see, I love you in the abstract, not in the concrete." The theme for what I am about to tell you is simply this. We must move this whole debate, this whole discussion on national clean energy from the abstract, where much of it is, to the concrete. From the academic to the applied. From the theoretical to the real, and from the tepid to the bold. Now, I was elected 4 years ago, and I never would have guessed that I would be driving a natural gas Suburban. I never guessed that my wife would be driving a hybrid car. I never guessed that we would live in a mansion, the governor's mansion, that is now powered by wind. You would have told me that 4 years ago. I would have told you you were crazy. Yet today, it is a reality. So if Mr. Pickens is looking for an example of a successful transition emerging in the country, look no farther than the great state of Utah. You see, in Utah, we have the most CNG refueling stations in the nation per person than anyone else. On a net-net basis, third after California and New York. Utah is number one for purchasing used, dedicated, and converted alternative fuel vehicles. In fact, I think we've purchased about every darn CNG car in the West. We can't find them anymore. We're converting our state fleets from the old cars to the new, which is hybrid and CNG, and are having a very difficult time getting a hold of them. So change is in the wind. Change is indeed in the wind. In 2002, 73 state tax credits were given out to Utahns who purchased or converted their vehicles to clean burning technology. Last year, we gave out nearly 700. Now that represents an eightfold increase in just 5 years. And to date, we've granted more than 1,600 tax credits since the program began, a way of making our state a little more efficient, a little cleaner, a little more affordable, and a little more independent, as they like to say. Now, we're all familiar with the history of oil. It goes back some 4,000 years. In fact, by the 10th century, extensive bamboo pipelines connected oil wells with salt springs. In the book Dream Pool Essays, written around 1088 AD, the scientist and statesman Shun Guo of the Song Dynasty used a simple two-character Chinese word, shiyou, literally meaning rock oil, to name the petroleum. And this word is still being used today in the contemporary Chinese language, which reminds me of the earliest oil wells which were drilled in China about 347 AD, just after the end of the Han Dynasty, which went from about 200 BC to about 200 AD, during which there was one of my favorite aphorisms spoken, which went something like this, and I think it puts everything we're talking about here in beautiful perspective. Hu shang bang mang, hu shang xue shi, which means simply, together we study, together we investigate, together we learn, and together we progress. How nice would it be if we could actually live by that dictate of working together on energy efficiency, on energy innovation? Well, we know a little bit about American political history with oil as well. History is complete with our ups and downs. We don't have to look much farther back beyond 1973, when oil was $3 to, say, $11 per barrel. Nixon launched his own energy independence strategy, 1976. Carter had his own energy plan. Solar by the year 2000. Today, it's 0.1% of production, which is so far below where it should be, it's laughable. 1992, the Clinton administration developed its own plans for an efficient car, never really took off. 2000, Bush came in with a $1.2 billion effort to try to develop a hydrogen fuel car. $1.2 billion for a hydrogen fuel car. The cost of a single B-2 bomber was the effort by this administration to try to make a contribution toward a hydrogen fuel car. At some point, we're going to begin to take this whole issue seriously. Now, oil dependence in the West, interestingly enough, was engineered, as we look historically, by none other than Winston Churchill. A short-term wartime strategy that turned into an oil addiction for the entire West. 1907, a remarkable period in the world. Then Winston Churchill, as the first Lord of the Admiralty, ran across an admiral in the Royal Navy, somebody by the name of John Fisher. Fisher made the recommendation that maybe Churchill consider converting the entire British fleet from coal, which they had in great abundance, to oil. Everyone was skeptical at the time, but Churchill took him up on the idea, recognizing the strategic need to go from coal to oil. Coal was difficult to transport. It was virtually impossible to refuel at sea. It was a logistic headache at the end of the day. Oil, on the other hand, had many great benefits over coal, including burning with less smoke, improved storage capabilities, more efficient ship design ultimately, and much more flexibility in transportation and refueling. And the decision was made. That transition began to occur in 1914, 1915 from coal to oil, and the world has never looked back. That was Churchill's first show. We need a second show. We need someone to reverse exactly those decisions that were made early on. We need a second act to reverse what Churchill did 100 years ago. His decision was short-term and strategic, but it left the world addicted. Now, in the meantime, as we're all searching for the best ideas out there, I think it's important to look for local examples around the United States that might have some national applicability in terms of best practices that exist in our country. Most Western governors, you see, are creating noteworthy models that I think deserve a look at. For example, in our great state of Utah, we're doing things that 4 or 5 years ago never would have been imagined. Three areas in particular I'd like to point out very briefly for you. One, reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We did something that I know most would never have thought politically possible in the state of Utah just a couple of short years ago. We joined the Western Climate Initiative in May of 2007 with the objective of reducing greenhouse gas emissions through development of a market-based system for affordable energy and improved energy security and independence. Because of this initiative, just recently, this year, Utah committed to reduce emissions to its 2005 level by 2020. No one ever guessed Utah would have been in this position a few short years ago. Number two, Utah today is a founding member of the Climate Registry, the National Registry for Greenhouse Gas Emissions, providing recognition for early reductions by industry and other entities. You see, you can't measure reductions in greenhouse gas unless you monitor. Utah's carbon footprint is now being measured. Number three, in 2007, we created this thing called Utah's Blue Ribbon Advisory Council on Climate Change. Never would have happened a few short years ago. It provided over 70 major policy options which are now being implemented to improve energy efficiency, reduce emissions, establish an affordable energy economy, and improve energy security and independence. Many thought and many said the idea would fall flat. What happened? We brought people together from all walks of life, from different perspectives, different standpoints. It was difficult and it was controversial, but it worked. And everyone sat together at a round table with an equal voice and an equal ownership in the discussion. And we talked about the future of our state and how much air quality and the next generation, which we're preparing a framework for, meant to those people around the table. Now, how great would it be if the federal government would ever do the same darn thing? Number two, renewable energy. Utah supported state and federal renewable energy tax credit extensions, which most people have done, but we have done something else that, again, a few short years ago, most would have thought absolutely impossible for a state with the energy mix of Utah. We enacted an unprecedented renewable portfolio standard, 20% of electricity generated from renewable energy sources by the year 2025. Number two, the Western Governors Association, this year of which I am chair, created the Western Renewable Energy Zone Initiative and the Utah Renewable Energy Zone Task Force, which is working to facilitate the identification and cost-effective transmission for corridors that bring electricity from new renewable energy sources to a grid, which today is a most rate-limiting feature for all of us as it relates to renewable energy and movement to greater renewable energy. Number three, energy efficiency, which to my mind is the lowest of low-hanging fruit for all of us who were interested in cleaning up our act. We created an executive order on energy efficiency to achieve 20% increase in energy efficiency by the year 2015, which is just around the corner. I think it probably represents the most ambitious attempt at energy efficiency of any state in the West. We have supported energy requirements for all new state buildings. We've established a revolving loan fund for agencies and state government to increase building efficiency standards. And just most recently, as Senator Reid mentioned, we have established a four-day, 10-hour work week for state employees to reduce energy use and commute cost. We call it the 410, Monday through Thursday. Same 40-hour week, we're just packaging it a little more intelligently, and we're doing it for the right reasons. We're doing it because on the energy efficiency side, how great is it when you can throttle back over 1,000 state buildings and facilities on Thursday night, as opposed to Friday night, have them down Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and by doing so, pick up an extra 20% increase in efficiency right off the top. And by doing so, Monday through Thursday, improve customer service hours by opening state government at 7 o'clock and closing at 6 o'clock, not a perfect overlap as it typically is with private sector hours, thereby giving the taxpayer who is asking for better services a little more in the way of opportunity to access government services. And third, the reason for doing it, good old-fashioned employee morale, where our wonderful state employees actually have the flexibility on Fridays to determine whether or not they want to fill their tank up with gas and drive into work. They don't have to make that decision, some coming from very far off destinations. So it's something that we're very excited about, something we're going to measure with underlying metrics for the next year. And a year from now, we're going to wake up and see if these metrics don't point in a positive direction for our state in all of these categories. And I'm here to tell you, I think they will. And I think it will create something of a new policy option for a lot of other states that are looking for a similar kind of uptick in terms of energy efficiency. Now let me turn just for a moment to go from the state to the region and speak for just a moment as a chair of the Western Governors Association. I'm here with Governor Ritter, who you're going to hear from in just a moment, who's a great friend. Janet Napolitano was here, I understand, just a little bit earlier. Now, what is significant about the West and energy, the 20 states of the West, California to Texas, Texas up to North Dakota, North Dakota into Washington State? This is the most energy-relevant region, not in the country, but in the world. And when you factor in the people who actually meet with the Western governors, who are the four Western premiers of Canada, you have, without question, the most energy-relevant region in the entire world. We are so tired, as governors, of inaction on the part of Washington that we have decided that Republican and Democrat alike, we are pulling together and we're going to draft our own energy policy proposal, which we're just now doing, and we're going to turn it over to whomever is elected president of the United States. I don't know who it's going to be, but here you have around a table Republican governors and Democrat governors sitting together fashioning an energy policy, because we live it every day, we breathe it every day, we have to create a vision for our citizens every day that speaks to energy efficiency and speaks to clean air and speaks to economies that actually function. So the pillars on which we are basing this energy policy that we'll ultimately hand over in the next 3 to 4 months, and we hope it's done by then, will be based on three primary pillars. One, affordability. Nothing much matters in energy policy unless at the end of the day we're delivering something for our citizens that speaks to affordability. Two is energy independence. Now, how great would it be if we could wake up one morning and find that we have something other than $700 billion fleeing our country every year, $10 trillion over the course of 10 years, the largest transfer of wealth in the history of humankind, in many cases landing in the countries of dictators and tyrants who are funding anti-American activities that don't serve our interests, obviously, overseas. Energy independence, the more and more we think about it as a country, and more we conclude that it is, in fact, a national security debate, the more I think our country is going to realize that this is going to have to be an important pillar of any energy policy as we go forward. The third simply is reduced emissions. I call it sustainability. Some people call it reduced emissions. We have to deal realistically with a world in which we have a changing climate, in which we have air quality problems, in which all of us find ourselves downstream from everybody else. Now, the plan that we're working on, and for that matter, any plan that is going to work in this country must include the following items. And let me just mention a few of them. Number one, conservation, which is little talked about, but to my mind probably has the greatest benefit over the short term. I'm talking about changing behavior. I'm talking about promoting public transportation. I'm talking about more efficient lights, like we put into the governor's mansion. It's a 102-year-old building, but we've gone through it all and changed all of the lights. My daughters don't like it in their bathroom, but we've done it nonetheless. More efficient buildings, improved building designs, on and on, LEED standards. You know what I'm talking about, all under the rubric of conservation. We've got to do a better job, all of us, in defining what conservation really means in all of our states, in all of our places of work, in setting targets for ourselves, because it can be done. Number two, regulatory infrastructure that moves toward more renewables. We all want to get there, but we face some hurdles as we move in that direction. Let me just give you one. Public service commissions that in many states are not savvy enough to deal with incentives for communities to pursue more renewables. We've got to start thinking differently in terms of the way we price and develop economic modeling for renewable energy. Number three, enhanced transmission capability. The West has inadequate transmission capability. Enough said about that. We can talk about putting renewable energy in the eastern part of our state where we have abundant wind or a lot of sun in the southern part of our state, but we are rate limited once again because of lack of transmission capability. This must be addressed. Number four, increased investment in energy research and development, wind, solar, carbon capture and sequestration, nuclear, they've all got to be worked on and forwarded. We have one great investigator at the University of Utah who's working on a $67 million Energy Department grant. He's a leading expert on carbon capture and sequestration. They've already tested the proposition in taking carbon and storing it in underground caverns where there is some promise in the years to come in terms of being able to commercialize this technology. Five, if we're going to deal with climate change realistically, we must put a value on carbon, something that has not been done, that must be done. Number six, and finally, we need to recognize that there's an international component to all of this as well, whether we're talking about energy efficiency or climate change. And I'm proud to say that under the banner of the Western Governors Association, we've included the Chinese government in our efforts to expand the dialogue on energy and climate. This has not been done. And how often do we hear that these discussions are a waste of time or all for naught because the Chinese are so far behind us? And it doesn't matter what we do, the Chinese are never going to catch us, at least not for a very long time. Well, I've heard enough of that, and we've decided as an organization that we're going to engage the Chinese. We brought them to our last meeting in Jackson Hole. We're going to have a delegation in China in the not-too-distant future, a reciprocal visit then by provincial leaders from China to the next WGA meeting in the state of Utah, and we're going to have some meaningful discussions on energy efficiency, new technologies, and climate. So no longer in this country will we have to say, we shouldn't act because you've got China and India. China, by the way, is producing 1,000 new cars, putting them on the road per day, building the equivalent of one new power plant per week. This discussion is a very important one and must take place, and we'll be doing it under the banner of the WGA. So, in short, lessons learned from Churchill as we begin to correct that decision made 100 years ago that was good for the British Navy, but got the rest of the West addicted to oil. The revolution from coal to oil as a transportation fuel required a lot of thinking and a lot of leadership. Even if today we can look back and say it took us in the wrong direction, it might have been the right strategic decision 100 years ago. Say what you will about it. But today, as they were 100 years ago, we're at a similar crossroad in human history. Oil, once a reliable and stable source of power, has become today a source of instability and conflict. We must identify and begin transitioning to new energy technologies. As with oil 100 years ago, the technologies already exist. As with 100 years ago, they are being used today. As with 100 years ago, they currently are being underutilized. As with oil 100 years ago, there are naysayers who say that a transition will be too difficult and fruitless. However, as with 100 years ago, there is a dire need for leadership to get us off the dime. So, my friends, it's time to be bold, from the abstract to the concrete, from the academic to the applied, from the theoretical to the real, from the tepid to the bold, the call to action for all of us must be crystal clear. And let us remember this. One, we have the brain power, but we lack the political leadership to get it done today. Two, we must dispense with partisanship and start focusing instead on the areas where there is significant agreement as opposed to just disagreement. Number three, I think we all need to understand that today in America, there is no issue more important or timely than getting clean energy policy right. Number four, like when John F. Kennedy stood at American University and gave that great speech in 1961, wanting to send a man to the moon and return him safely to Earth, everyone in America understood that vision. Everyone could repeat that vision. Everyone from the great scientists in America right on to the young kids in their living rooms watching it all play out. It was a moonshot. It was a vision. The same kind of thing is going to be required if we're going to get it right. It's going to require the kind of focus and commitment that every sector of life in America must bring to the table. Fifth, if done right, this issue alone will ensure our economic, competitive, clean, and secure future. We must do better. We must think bigger. We must be bolder. Thank you all so very much for having me. Thank you.